Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Well, we all knew it was going to happen sooner or later, right? The debt pile was going to morph into a deflationary monster that was going to put the hurt on the global economy and financial system or systems. More and more, it seems like 2016 is going to be the year that things will get, shall we say, interesting. But our predicaments extend well beyond some ill-conceived debt habits and include many other self-inflicted wounds, such as destroying our soils while feeding ourselves toxic food, miseducating our youths, and delivering poisoned water to Flint, Michigan. There are 1,000 self-inflicted wounds to discuss, unfortunately more every day. Well, what can a person do in light of all this? What should a person do? Is there anything a person can do? Fortunately, there are a few voices of reason out there, helping to band together those of us inflicted with common sense and the ability to draw our own conclusions. Yes, there are things that can be done. And the first is to educate yourself to know what's going on. The second is to close the gap between what you know to be true and your daily actions. You need to increase your resilience along a variety of dimensions and not wait for things to get any worse before you decide to leap to action. To talk with us today, very special guest, a man who began his efforts to reach out, inform, and offer solutions around the same time I did. With us today is Jack Spierko, the host and owner of the Survival Podcast, the motto of which is helping you live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Welcome, Jack.
Hey, Chris. Nice to be on your show. Turn things around for a change instead of me interviewing you.
I'm really happy to, of course, because you're a fascinating guy. I've always enjoyed our interviews. But let's introduce you to people. Tell us about your background.
Well, great. I come from a sales and marketing background, really. That was the primary component of my, I guess you'd say, professional career. I did that for about 20 years, eventually moving into the position where I was the owner of one company outright and had several other companies I had partners in and was living the, quote, American dream, which meant I was overweight and headed for a heart attack by 40.
Yeah.
Completely miserable and really didn't want to do that anymore. And I had a client that wanted a website set up, which is what one of the companies did. And they wanted a podcast and a blog and all this other stuff. And this is all the way back in 2008 when it was a little bit new anyway. At least the podcast thing was as far as being mainstream like it is today. And so I bid the job and we got the job and I took it back to my lead developer and said, here, do this. And he said, well, I can do all of this except this podcast feed stuff. I've never done that before. And I'm like, just build the site, do the comps, do everything, and I'll figure out how the podcast works. So I was really familiar with WordPress. So I found out it was like install a plugin and put a link in and you're good. So I said, let me make sure this works and understand how to make sure I put in there getting him into iTunes, the feeds and all that. And so I decided, well, I'll do a podcast. So I took an $18 Sony digital recorder and a $20 beat-up, taped-together Plantronics headset that I had laying around, and I started doing my show, and that was in June of 2008. I did that for about a year and a half, and after a year and a half, I had built it to a point where I went, you know what? I can take this full-time, and I can walk away from all that other stuff. So I went to my partners and sold out my interest for a fraction of what it was worth, and they all thought I was crazy, and I took the show full-time, and I've been doing that now. So about 7 years since I did that. And I have gone into every aspect of self-reliant and self-sufficient living, whether it's the homesteading stuff, whether it's financial education, you name it, I've gone into it. A lot of it from my personal background. I kind of grew up a country boy where they still closed school on the first day of deer season. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of exposure to people that were a little bit more affluent than me, so their financial advisors weren't not the financial advisors everybody else gets, if you know what I mean. People that you have to be a, what's the word I'm looking for?
Accredited.
Accredited investor to even work with, right? So they know things and they talk about things that the guy from Edward Jones will never do. And that had a lot of insight for me. And by the time I went full time, then I was able to bring on guests. I was able to do call-ins and broaden that. And we've done 1,714 episodes as of today. And if you want to know about something in this world, we probably have content on it.
And didn't you not start this in your car?
Yes, I've left that out, right? So obviously, if you're, I was working like 60, 70 hours a week. So obviously, you can't do that and, you know, have a recording studio set up and all. So yeah, that headset and that Sony recorder, I'd lay that on my lap in my car. I'd get up about 3:30 in the morning, put my outline together for the show that day, put a couple 5x7 index cards, throw them on the console of the car, and drove 55 miles to my office every day. And I would record the show in the morning and upload it once I got there. All the notes and all already done. So it was like 10 minutes of work. And it was my company, so if anybody didn't like it, I didn't care. And when I drove home, I would actually listen to my own show. My wife thought it was arrogance. It was absolutely the opposite of arrogance. I was the most critical person of myself for that year that anybody ever was. I did it like, I don't know if you played like sports in high school or whatever, but like I played football, and we had the old, you know, reel-to-reel videos of some of our games, and we'd watch them, and you never watched it to see what you did right. You watched it to see what you did wrong.
Right.
And I think that made me pretty good at what I do, because I had that year of like, I can't really be blamed for sucking because I'm doing this in a car while weaving in and out of traffic, but yet being hard on myself. And I think there's a lesson there in just about anything you want to do.
Well, you know, we have such parallel stories in that, because it was almost the identical timing. So it was, I guess it was May of 2008. I first started to put the crash course down. And, you know, this was the time I'd investigated all these different technologies. It was very frustrating. I had all these big ideas. It was this monster PowerPoint show that I could do live, but how was I going to put it on the web? And I had to learn Flash animation. And long story short, I had the same Plantronics headset. And it was me reading off of a script and dialing through the slides, you know, in real time, trying to capture all of that, doing minimal audio editing. And I would just listen ruthlessly. If I had a mouth click, something was wrong, you know, the dog barks, whatever, I would have to do the whole thing over again. Because I didn't have the right editing capabilities. And some of these chapters are 20 minutes long. So to start it over again was like just, oh, God.
Especially at 19 minutes and 37 seconds in. You're like, oh!
I had several of those, right? And, of course, my home office was in my home. And, you know, every so often at 19 minutes and 30 seconds, the wife, bless her heart, would open the door and say, you know, I'm going to the store. What do you want? I had all these moments, right? But that's...
I wanted you to go to the store 20 minutes ago.
So it, you know, it's just part of life. But that was actually, I still look back on that and go, what was the inspiration? Where did that come from? So I'm wondering, where did your inspiration come from? Like what drove you to say, I got to do this?
Well, the subject of the podcast was driven by the fact that, as I mentioned, I really knew that market correction, recession, depression, misery, whatever you want to call it, was coming. I don't mean I thought it was coming. I don't mean that I felt that it might come. I meant that I absolutely in my bones knew what was going to happen. And I, you know, I had employees, and I'm telling my own employees with 401k plans that I helped them set up, please move your money to the cash value fund or the bond fund or something, because you're going to get punched in the face. And they had like this vapor lock in their head, like, oh, the guy that was here, the financial guy, he said, oh, okay, whatever, man. And I realized that there had to be, you know, callous Americans that were in that same kind of static vapor lock. So I wanted to talk about the financial uncertainty, but I also had kind of come back to the world of being what people call a prepper, but what we always just called being smart when I grew up, right after 9/11. And we can get to that in a second, but it had nothing to do with fear over 9/11. It had to do with being, I was away from my family and I couldn't get home, and my wife's crying and my kid's scared. And I'm like, I got to change my life. And that got me off the road, so to say. But I had been in that world ever since. So I wanted to merge those two. And then I was like, can I really do a daily podcast on this? And then when I started to think of, well, how many things fit under this? Sure, we can talk about storing some extra food or growing some extra food, but we can talk about, you know, buying silver, buying gold, when to, when not to, how to, and how not to. We can go into all of these things people get misled by, like, you know, let's get a physical metal IRA. Yeah, great. Let's take the most private wealth on planet Earth and make it as public as possible and as subject to government regulation as possible. That's a great idea. And I just started like kind of peeling back those layers of the onions, and I'd realized that like this 20, 25 year history of my life that seemed so disjointed, because I'd gone from any job that took me up or gave me new experience, I took it. I was not the good employee. I was great at what I did, but I was in it for me, and it seemed very selfish, and it was because, well, they were in it for them. And all of that vast experience from stuff in telecommunications and marketing, sales, being able to communicate well, had led me up to a point like, this makes sense. This is what I can do. The other thing was, I had this little garden at the time. We had a conventional, you know, the success house, you know, which is surrounded by other success houses that you can reach out the window and touch.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my little garden in the back, and I would get home at the end of the night, and I would come in from work, and I would walk through the door, and I'd grab a beer out of the refrigerator, and I'd go out the back door, and my wife just wouldn't say a word. And I'd go out there and I'd water my garden. I'd become human again. And then I would come in and say, hey, honey, how you doing? We had a normal life after that. But I needed decompression just from 55-mile drive on the road. Even listening to me talk, I wanted to, like, just explode when I got home. And I realized there was something about producing your own food that actually connected you with your humanity to the point where you could actually be human again. And I realized that that could be a big part of what I could do, and I could give that to other people. And with all of that, that made it worth getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, 3:30 in the morning, to get that stuff done.
Great story. I totally resonate with lots of that. And so this idea, though, that you knew that it was coming in 2008, you knew it was coming. I did, too. I had a lot of and a variety of people did. Of course, after the fact, everybody saw it coming. But it's been a kind of a dry spell for a while. And there have been, you know, just outrageous, heroic efforts, heroic golf claps for the plutocrats. They've been amazing in dumping money in and patching this over and lying, cheating, swindling, stealing, propagandizing, whatever they need to do. You know, this is just, I feel like we're in the, my assessment, we're in the chewing gum and duct tape portion of this story, right? Where everything that can be done has been done to keep this thing floating along. What's your sense of where we are right now?
Well, I had people freaking out 2 years ago, and I'm like, it's probably the election year that this is all going to happen. So I have to be kind of careful that I'm not letting confirmation bias, you know, influence my take of what's going on, because since it matches up, there's always like, you see what I told you, and now I see it, right?
Right.
But when I look at it, here's kind of how I saw this coming. I really believe that when we get the fourth quarter numbers from 2015, which you get in like the first quarter of 2016, they're not going to be good. They're going to be worse than expected, and that we're going to be in a negative growth or almost no growth situation. And in this quarter, it's definitely. So I'm thinking by the middle of this year, I think we're in a recession now, but I think we're in an official recession. And you know the psychological impact of that. And I think there's a big unwinding to come at the end of this one. Though my gut is, never underestimate the ability of these people to kick a can. And I don't see this as like our final financial oblivion. Though long ago, I kind of felt this might be when it would be. So when was I right and when was I wrong? I guess we'll find out. But what I see has happened now is they took so much money, and they pump so much liquidity into all these markets. In large, what we're seeing now is the consequences of creating an expansion boom without the necessary expansion to go along with it. We've built things that no one's going to use. We've mined product that nobody's going to want for another 5 years. It's sitting there. We've built buildings that nobody wants to occupy. They took so much. And you can see this in strip mall creation in America, right? Mm-hmm. You can drive up and down streets in nice neighbor, you know, right outside of nice neighborhoods where you have all these little strip malls for convenience sake and all. And you see all these brand new strip malls put in with 50% occupancy. And you have to ask, how did that thing get there? Like, because it's brand new. And it got there because it was so cheap to build. Employment wasn't doing really well. The construction workers were laid off. They would take anything they could get, so you could get cheaper than normal cheap labor, and you could get financing for cheap. So everybody took advantage of this, from the small-time strip mall to the giant city expansions made in China, and all of this stuff was built, and everybody geared up to meet the demand. You can't just shut that back down. You can't go out and spend $20 million on a single piece of mining equipment, get $5 million worth of production out of it, and then just shut the key off and expect that that's going to work. And that's happened all over the world right now. In some ways, it's a little less toxic than the housing meltdown. In some ways, it's larger. It's less toxic because on the surface, the numbers are smaller. I saw numbers come out today with people freaking out on Zero Hedge and all that there's, you know, a few $100 billion of exposure to bad loans in the oil sector. I'm not saying that's sunshine and roses, but compare that to what, $14 trillion of exposure in the housing market in 2008, 2009. So on the surface, these numbers are smaller. But when you start tracing how far they run and how many places they intersect and how many sectors, it's bigger. So the question is, how long will it unravel before they figure out how to pump it back up again with something else? And I don't think I know the answer to that, but I've been, like you, amazed. Amazed at the ability of these people to perpetuate an unperpetuatable system.
Or sustain the unsustainable, as I say. Yes. And yeah, so this is a faith-based system, and we need a lot of faith. But you've touched on an important point here for me, which is that one of the reasons I'm really keying on the oil sector, besides the fact that it's something I focus on a lot professionally, is that a wipeout in the oil sector is not the same as a wipeout in the housing sector. And the simple reason is, and I know I'm going to offend a few people when I say this, a house is not an asset.
Correct.
A house is a liability. An asset is something that generates cash flow, is fundamentally productive. A house is fundamentally unproductive. As soon as you buy it, that thing is depreciating. It is a money pit. You can see the movie. They've made movies about it. You can read the story. Get the book. But it's a house is not doesn't do anything except you get to live in it, you know, and the government plays numbers with, you know, statistics and stuff like that to explain why it's more important than it is. But it's not. It's a depreciating asset. But oil. Oil is this magic substance that we pull out of the ground and we can use it to perform all sorts of downstream work for us. And who can predict what that would be, but it comes out of the ground. And so this is really astonishing that this oil downturn is now worse in severity, magnitude, duration than the one that we had in 1986. And so the thinking is that we're just sort of going to skate by this. There's a couple hundred billion on the hook, but it's not just that. It's what you hinted at. There's all sorts of associated value on the line here. It's not just the roustabout who is earning $48,000 a year, but the car that they're trying to pay off and the house that they bought and the waitresses that they support and whatever else they're going. So to me, this downturn is colossal, just not even from the U.S. perspective, but from a global flow of liquidity perspective. The sovereign wealth fund of Norway has been a net accumulator to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars for 13 years running. And this year, that goes into reverse. Saudi Arabia slips into reverse. Venezuela, nightmare. So it's actually a pretty big story. But what I'm reading in the media, Jack, pretty regularly is, don't worry about it. It's kind of small.
Well, you know what I've always said to that? When somebody says, don't worry about it, worry.
Yeah.
I had a friend named Mikey. We used to call him Ears because he had giant ears and he was not the sharpest tool in the shed. And whenever we were involved with something, even as stupid teenagers, and this guy said, don't worry about it, we all looked at each other with a great deal of fear and concernment, and Mikey went on his own from after that point. I think that when you start hearing the media tell you not to worry about something, you need to worry about it. Because the media told you not to worry about this in 2008 when you and I were telling people, hey, worry about this. And then you have mouthpieces like Susie Orman coming on going, it'll be fine, don't worry about it, like Mickey Mouse she sounds. And 2 years later, she's going, you're going to be working till you're 70 now. That's just the way it is. And it's like, oh my God, how does anybody listen to these dolts? So I didn't mean to cut you off there, but when somebody says, do not worry about it, that is exactly the time that you need to worry. And I think what people cannot understand is people like you and I can say, listen, get out of your mutual funds, your stocks, et cetera, right now. If you're holding stocks, you better be holding stocks for a specific reason. You know why you're holding them. You have an exit strategy. Don't be in general funds right now. I told people that back in August of last year. I said the reason to get out of the market right now is not because it's going to crash. It's because there is no upside to the market for the rest of the year. So there's no reason to be at risk. And we can say that. Can you see what would happen if someone like another one of my favorite mouthpieces, Jim Cramer, or a guy that I actually like a lot more, what's his name, Dave Ramsey, went on the radio to millions of Americans on Fox News and whatever and said, right now you should get completely out of the stock market. What, you tell me what the result of that would be.
Well, they would be fired and they would never be invited
I'm
back, right?
Talking about that. I'm talking about what would be the results on the street when somebody with that reach and that clout tells America, bail out. You'll bail, right? You'd have a massive triggered sell-off. You and I have the freedom to say that for two reasons. One, who's going to fire Chris Martinson or Jack Spirico? No one, except our own listeners. But two, because we're not going to create an exodus of 5 or 6 million stockholders in a day. These people can. They're literally traps. No matter how honest they want to be, they can't tell you what they know. I'll bet you that Dave Ramsey did not sit through the stock downfall of 2008-2009 like he told his listeners to.
You know, you've touched on what for me is an important point, and this is personal. So I was at this wealth conference recently, and I had an opportunity to speak. There were hundreds of billions of dollars under management. There were pension fund managers there. There were you know, hedge fund dudes and dudettes, all this, right? It's like big place. And the first thing I did when I stood up in front of them, Jack, is I said, hey, I'm standing up in front of you as an outsider, and I'm not trying to become an insider. And the luxury that comes with being an outsider is I get to say whatever I want. So let me tell you this story, right? It's really important to have outsiders in this story because what you're talking about, the center mass, here's the number one rule of manias and panics, right? Is the number one job of a bear market is to take the most money from the most people at all times. Here's my complaint with the media, as I understand it, the lapdogs that they are of the system, is that they're encouraging people to stay fully invested at exactly the wrong moment, right? And I will know personally it's time to get back into and start considering buying equities when the media is telling me it's over, never invest in stocks again. Because that's, of course, when their Wall Street handlers will be telling them, say that kind of stuff, right? I this sounds a little conspiratorial, but I've seen this happen over and over again where the media is routinely telling people exactly the wrong stuff, either on purpose or because they're idiots. But, where do you draw the line on that? What do you think?
I think it's exactly what's going on. I also think it's almost impossible on these big dips that are short-term dips. Like everybody talks about the crash of 87. But if you look at it, all the stocks you really wanted to own in 1987 that went down like a rock were down for a matter of seconds.
Right.
And that was before high frequency trading and all this skimming and stuff that's going on now. And I remember being a kid in high school and my old man explaining this to me and not getting it. And then I just watched it happen again. We had a huge dip in the late part of 2015, a one-day big giant dip like 500 points.
August 24th. It was awesome.
Right? And there were big stocks that went down. And I covered this. The big stocks were down for less than a minute.
Right.
Right? All of the regular rigmarole stuff that makes up the majority of your mutual fund, right? I'm not saying all the expensive stocks. I'm taking all the premium stocks, the ones you wanted to own this year. They were down that fast. You could have been sitting on E-Trade. You could have known the second that was coming. And you could have tried to buy that stock at that price. And the private trader would have never bought that stock. But let me tell you something. Somebody did, or it would not have gone back up. Now, when you just consider, like you always talk about, I believe this because I can do math. If you do that math, it only points to one place. There's only a select group of people that can actually buy stock that quickly. And they bought the exact right ones at the exact right second perfectly. Now, either these are the smartest people in the world and they should be inventing free energy, okay, or they're in on it. Now, those are your two choices there. To me, that's common sense.
Yeah, you know, that's what's astonishing about that was it clearly speaks to a broken market, right? So we have a broken market. Your father would not even recognize this even after having seen 1987, right? Broken markets run by computers. And so the NYSE thought about this and said, geez, we have these computers. They're just running like crazy. They're dipping these giant stocks for just a minute at a time, just wiping people out. What are we going to do? So as of February this year in 2016, the NYSE said, here's our response. Ordinary traders, retail investors will no longer have either good to close or stop limit orders available to them, meaning that you couldn't put a stop in there that says, hey, if IBM ever goes to a penny, I'll buy, right? They took that right away from you. Under the auspices of, oh, we're going to protect the children, think of the children, what we're going to do is prevent you from accidentally putting a stop loss in there that gets, you know, picked off by one of these high-frequency computers. It's like, oh, look at that tasty stop loss order sitting, you know, 100 points below where we're currently sitting. I'll go grab that. to protect you instead of fixing the market.
I want to just make sure I understand you because this is news to me. Are you saying that as of February, I'm not going to be able to run a basic stop loss or just these?
Not on the NYSE.
So you're telling me if I just have a stock, and this is what I do now, if a stock goes up to a certain point and I'm not ready to take my profits on it yet, I put a stop loss underneath it, a couple bucks to preserve my profit, so that it, and I collar it all the way up like that. And you're telling me as a private trader, I won't be able to do that anymore.
That's correct.
Oh, gee, that fixes that. Now, see, what that actually does, that actually makes me far more concerned.
Right.
Because don't think that these high-frequency people need that. That's not how they do it.
Right.
If they don't do it, you pay more money right now for a box that's 20 feet closer to the exchange because of the time it takes for the signal to go through the wire. They're not doing this with stop losses. They're not doing this with collaring stocks. They're doing this with real-time engagement. They don't need that. It's the same as saying we're not going to let rich people take their money out of the country, and that means you and me. The billionaire's money's already out of the country. You're not getting it back.
Right.
That makes me far more concerned about what's about to happen.
Correct. So it's February 26. I'm looking at it right now. All existing good to close and stop orders on the NYC book will be canceled at that time. You're out. So yeah, that's no longer an option for you. But it just, again, the markets are broken and they've now enshrined it in favor of the big players, the ones with the co-located servers with the slightly shorter fiber optic cable so they can shave that microsecond off the transmission time. Those people, they've said, they now own the markets. You are no longer allowed to play in this. And people were making that argument for a while. Ah, but you know, Chris, you know, so what? You lose a fraction of a penny on a trade. It's more liquid, all this and that. But now I can't put stop orders in. I have to babysit my positions like live, real time, 24/7, like I'm a computer. I'm out. I can't do that. I'm done.
No, that changes everything for me. What that may actually result in is the return of the full service broker. I mean, there's times when. I am not a person that says hold no stocks, though right now I'm very limited in my exposure on equities. There is money to be made if you know what you're doing. But I also like to go away for 2 weeks at a time.
Right.
And I don't spend my vacations with my smartphone checking my stock prices every 5 minutes. And I'm not a day trader. I'm a guy that sees trends, and basically I get out of the way of trains, you know. And that's what 2008, 2009 was. You and I get a lot of credit for telling people this is coming, but I honestly look back, dude, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to what you said about it or anything, because I said it too, but I'm like, how did you not?
Right.
Right? So exactly. I don't time the market daily, but I mean, some of these things, like this what we're heading to in 2016, this to me is as clear as daylight. And like I said, the piece of information you just gave me makes me a lot more concerned. And I have to say this, you know, with a little sadness for other people. I don't know as much stuff like that anymore because part of like my mental health regime is I've solidified my positions and I have exited a lot of the news and stuff. And I rely on my audience to tell me things that are actually worthy of my attention because the news and all of the media that's out there is some of the most misleading stuff. And I say that with some concern because I also include a lot of the hype behind what we call alternative media. You know, I'm on your show because I like what you do and you're a real grounded person. But a lot of this stuff that I see come out on like Zero Hedge and all, it's just as hyped up in the opposite direction. And so I try to look at the bigger trends. But when I see, you know, Caterpillar equipment that was sold for $2 million being auctioned off for $100,000 a year later, I know something bad is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is really important. How do we actually pull the signal from the noise? There are lots of competing interests out there. So let's start with your source of the signal. What are the most popular subject or sets of subjects among your listeners right now?
Right now, people seem to be far more concerned about providing for themselves than what's going to go wrong next.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of the questions I get revolve around things like producing your own food, producing your own energy, finding a place to live that's less obscured by restrictions and regulations of the government. But I do get a lot of concerns about, and you know, the biggest one right now is the economy. Ironically, when no one's worried about the price of oil, right, because the gas is going down and everybody's happy when it's cheaper to fill your car, it's usually one of the worst times for the economy. And it kind of surprises me that a lot of times my own listeners don't seem to make the connection that like, yeah, it's good that gas is cheap, but, and it's like the reason gas is cheap is the but. And so I get it from all walks of life. I get a lot of questions right now, more and more questions about gun ownership, developing your skills for self-defense and protection. What we don't talk about, even though my show is called the Survival Podcast, we don't talk a lot about bunkers. We don't talk a lot about 20 years worth of MREs. We don't really talk about stuff like that. It's probably because I laid the groundwork from the beginning. What we talk about primarily is lifestyle design is what I call it. And I think I picked that up from Tim Ferriss. I'm not sure. I pick up a lot of things from a lot of places, but I always try to give credit. But lifestyle design. And that's really been key for probably the last 5 years. Because what I tell people every day, in fact, just today on the show, I said it again, if you don't design your lifestyle, somebody else is going to. And I think the reason we're so concerned about all of these things like a recession or what have you is because we're so tied in to the success of the system that if the system hiccups, we get hurt. And what I've tried to teach people to do is divorce themselves in phases because you can't do it overnight. I when I do shows on starting your own business, you know, I'll say, this does not mean you go in and tell your boss you quit and burn the bridge on the way out the door yet, right? You have to phase these things in. So while it's run the gamut right now, it's this stuff with the economy. You know, my email's blowing up today with concerns over the bank's exposure to the oil industry. It kind of runs the same flow, which is nice because that means I don't have to pay attention. Like, I have this incredible research staff, you probably do too, and all this stuff just shows up and I kind of filter through it. So I guess I have a cheat that way.
Yeah, well, you know, it's to me, it's just a process of I never trust any one source anymore. And
no.
Everything has to be multi-sourced. And I'm pretty sure that I have no real clue what's going on. And I'm equally positive that if it comes out of the State Department or the New York Times or the Washington Post, I have to double, triple, extra discount it. Because it's just, listen, this is a game for all the marbles. That, you know, the way I've put this is, we are in the deep stages of a very ill-advised debt expansion. And this either blows up or it continues. And the powers that be are very interested in it continuing. And I get it. I totally get it. You put me in their shoes. I'm not making any different decisions. Just get me through one more week. I get it. But at the same time, for the people who are thinking that somehow they're going to open their newspaper above the fold, be told about stuff in a useful amount of time, I don't hold that same view. That's most of my work. It's like, no, we're going to have to get our information from somewhere else. So you know what I'm tracking this last couple of weeks? We're watching the headline stock indexes are sort of gyrating, giving people a little bit of gas pains. But just like 2008, Jack, please pay attention to the banking index and the insurers and the other financially sensitive stocks. They are not tiptoeing out the back door. They are tripping over each other to get out of a burning nightclub. Kind of, it's just astonishing. So we see it again, and here we are again. But most people, I think, got lulled back into thinking that the system was going to work, that they all had it under control, and that somehow they would be told in advance. I don't think that's how it works anymore. I think they're actually very good at obfuscating and hiding what's actually happening for most people, even though if you scratch at it, it's completely obvious.
I think that one of the things that's tripping people up right now is there's no, like, when we had the last couple big downturns, there were clear, obvious things that people could get their head around as to being the problem. When people can't pay their mortgage and you have millions of people in default, people get that that's going to be a problem. When you have a massive terrorist attack, people get that there's going to be a problem with the economy. When you have a sector like going all the way back to 99, the dot-com sector, it explode. And then as you kind of saw the bubble bust coming for that, you could just look at it and go, you have all these companies that have taken all this money and not made a dime of profit except for a handful of them. And by the way, that handful is still around, just saying. You could kind of see the reasoning for that. The Enron implosion, it was a big enough company that people could, and it was all kind of merged together. So people look at this now, and if there's anything people really don't understand, it is the oil market. They don't get it. I'm no friend of Exxon and BP or whatever, but they don't understand how much work, risk, effort, et cetera, it is to extract a single barrel of oil for the first time, from the first time out of a hole in the ground, and actually make that into gasoline and put it into a car. And it's easy to attack the oil companies when oil's over $100 a barrel and you're paying too much and you're angry and the airlines are using an excuse to raise prices and all. But when you start to see a barrel of oil trading around $30, that somebody had to drill a hole miles into the ground on a horizontal system at the bottom of the ocean, pump out of the ground, ship back to the land, then refine into gasoline, sell for that price, and you start to realize that we pay $2 for a cup of coffee, you start to realize that something has to be bad wrong on the consumption side. It has to be. And then you have to ask yourself, why is there something wrong? Now, I'm not saying that consuming less is a bad thing of itself, but if we're expecting things to be the way that they are, like the way that they're just generally accepted as being, is the way all the people that don't pay attention like you and I and our listeners do, and they're, you know, for it to be that way, and that consumption plummets, not because of green energy, not because of new initiatives, but because it's just not there, why isn't that energy being used? Why is it sitting there? Why is the oil company now willing to take, and I have heard projections as low as getting down into, you know, like the teens per barrel of oil. Why are we willing to do that? Why are they willing to do that? Because they got to get something for it, and that's all that they can get. And what I don't think people understand about energy is a 1% to 2% shortage can create a skyrocket in price, but a 1% to 2% surplus can create a plummeting price. And the oil companies can't just produce less. They're in this catch-22. And this runs really deep if you start thinking about it that way. And yet you're talking about the insurers and all trying to run out of the door and leave the check on the table for you and me. And then you couple that with, you know, circumventing the casual trader's option to determine when they can exit. And it seems like a recipe for real pain. But and see, this is where I'm sure you struggle with this too, Chris. I don't know how to explain this to people. Whenever I say this is not the final crash of the market, we are not going down into oblivion to the end of the world, it's like I've said it's going to be sunshine and roses. Do you ever deal with that where you're like, hey, this is going to be bad, but it's not the end of the world, and then people start like thinking you're saying it's all going to be okay?
You know, it's a fantastic question, and it's one on my list here because. You know, what we're really talking about is the various scenarios. And I'll admit to you, I'll admit to everybody listening that I have certain scenarios that I have planned for and I've prepped for that are not unthinkable. Things that could maybe, I don't know, make the electricity grid go dark for sure, a few months or things like that. But in terms of most likely, oh, no, listen, it's never a one-way trip to the bottom. It's always a process. It collapse isn't an event. It's a process. These processes take an amount of time that's similar to the magnitude of what you're talking about. It's like the Titanic, right? You know, yeah. My dinghy can sink pretty goddamn quick, but a Titanic, that's a process. You know, it might take an hour or two, you know, or more, or however long it takes. So I think that yes, I have no question about the trajectory of this. I'm pretty convinced, Jack, you know, in 20 years, people look back and go, man, we had easier lives then, right? But between here and there, a lot of territory, local mileage is going to vary. Nobody can predict how this is going to unfold. So what's the best strategy? Well, you have to be ready for a lot of different things. That's taxing. And so that's why I think most people kind of get chucked off to the side. Some people want the certainty. It's so much easier to say, dude, tell me it's all going to fall apart next Wednesday. I can prep for that, right?
But they can't. See, that's the thing. They think they can. And what it is we've had these people predicting this is the big one, this is the big one, this is the big one for 25 years. And these are people that are hucksters that just want to make money. EndofAmerica3.com and this crap with Porter Stansberry. And yeah, the world's going to end in 6 months. The dollar will collapse. And people have been marketed that. And here's my concern, that eventually what's going to happen is it's going to become Chicken Little. Mm-hmm. And when we really are at a point where you and I are going, oh, guys, really, no one's going to listen.
Yeah.
Until it is above the fold, where there won't be a newspaper anymore by then, and it'll be careened into oblivion. But as far as like the preparedness, so being prepared for the grid to go down for a couple months, great goal, wonderful. But I look at preparedness this way. If you and I are in a car together, and we are going to drive from Miami, Florida to Portland, Maine, we are going to go to Georgia before we go to Virginia, unless we're really dumb people without a map. Uh-huh. Okay, so when somebody asks me that question, my first question is, do you have 30 days worth of food stored up in your home? No? Stop worrying about the grid going down. Do you have enough money to go 90 days without income and be okay? Not happy, but at least okay at the end of those 90 days. No? Let's not worry about it. Do you have a basic blackout kit so if your grid goes down for 24 hours, you can find your stuff and be comfortable? No? So we've got to get in preparedness all of these most basic things done. And what I came up with very early on was what you call an impact scale and disaster probability with an inverse relationship. And the way I look at this is a disaster that affects just you or just you and your immediate family is the most likely disaster that you will ever experience in your lifetime. You'll probably experience many of them. If you widen that out to be your neighborhood, it's a little less likely you as an individual will be impacted by it. And as we go up to a national level disaster, your odds of having it happen to you on any given individual day, I think this generation, we're going to see it, right, eventually, but on any given day is relatively low. So we have to take this methodical approach. We prepare first for the disasters that only affect us and our family. Then we prepare at the neighborhood level. Then we kind of prepare at the regional level. And by the time you get there, you're so close to being able to at least be somewhat resilient on these wide-scale disasters and so far ahead of where you would be otherwise that it's doable now. However, if you start out with no preparedness and you start pumping money into solar panels and backup batteries and stuff to the tunes of thousands and thousands of dollars and you can't handle being laid off for a month, then you're going to sooner or later you're going to end up hurt and you're going to never get where you're going to go. These are the people that get in the car and figure out how to get to, you know, to end up going from Virginia back to Georgia before they get to Maine. And sooner or later, you're going to get lost because clearly you have no map. So with preparedness, we have to start out with this methodical, let's prepare to be without services for a day. Now let's get prepared for a week. Now let's get prepared for a month. And it's actually so easy to do that way. And then if you add in common sense lifestyle, I know you garden and you plant fruit trees and stuff like that. And you talked about a home being a liability. The home is always going to be a liability to a degree because they tax it, et cetera. But if you take home with a certain size piece of land and you start to turn that land into a producer, you create an asset within that liability, if that makes sense. And these are the steps you have to take to get where you're going prepared wise, because most people don't have the time, the budget, or the resources to get prepared for the apocalypse by Wednesday. Mm-hmm. They might feel like they do because, well, if it's all over, and this is the other thing. People think that, like, when this collapse comes, that it'll be easier in some ways. I think some people actually have these fantasies, romantic fantasies about collapse. Well, I'll just have my gun, and I'll be able to defend what's mine, and no one will be able to take it from me. I won't worry about paying my debts off because everything's going to be broke anyway, and they can't repossess it. That's not how collapses work, man. Look at Argentina, right? Mm-hmm. The government gets stronger. The government gets bigger. The powers that be want more, and they'll take it too. So you have to set that resiliency up in a phased-in approach.
Very well said. Very well said. And it brings me to the motto in your site, which is helping you live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. And this is really, you know, a motto that Adam and I have as well in slightly different format, but it's essentially the same, which is, look, I'm not living for some future that might or might not arrive. What I'm doing is structuring my life in such a way that I have a very high quality life today. But if A, B, C, or D happens, all of these things that I'm doing today also play into that, work out very, very well. I'm not into this to wear a hair shirt. And I think the people, you know, you're mentioning who think that somehow things get easier when the collapse comes, I'm highly ambivalent. I'm really cheering the collapse on and desperately afraid of it happening. I'll be completely honest about that. I'm cheering it on because we need to have some hard conversations. And it looks like my country is unwilling to go there and have the appropriate conversations until forced to, right? But so I want to have those conversations. We have to have them. But at the same time, I'm really not looking forward to this coming because I know it's going to be really hard for a lot of people, myself included, no matter how well I prepared.
Yeah, and it is. And there's nobody that's going to come through the eventual reality of this that's going to feel better off while it's going on. But we don't know when it's going to happen. Again, you've said it. I've said it, I've been astounded at the ability to kick this can. We don't know what developments will come. A lot of this is psychological. The American dollar has value because people believe that it has value. I personally believe that most people don't even know what money really is. Mm-hmm. Most people that think, woken up to like the scam of the dollar, fractional reserve banking, all the stuff you have in Crash Course, will then turn around and say, gold is money. No, gold is a commodity. Gold is a thing. Gold can be exchanged for things. It has a lot of things going for it. I'm a big fan of gold. But in the end, you can't eat it. If you eat enough of it, it's toxic. It'll kill you. It really doesn't do anything that any other substance can't do. In fact, silver, industrial-wise, does a lot more than gold does. It's just another thing. Money is an agreement. Money is a psychological agreement for a symbol that represents energy to be exchanged in lieu of direct barter. That's what it is. It's nothing more than that. That's why something like Bitcoin can even work, because people don't understand that they are the value in the economy. They are the value along with the natural resources and the value add that human beings apply to those to create value. So money is just a representation. So if there's enough confidence in a currency, even if it's completely illogical, like the dollar, and the dollar is the most illogical thing, if you had it actually before that ever existed, explained it to someone who fully understood what you were saying before anybody had ever done it, and said, do you think we should do this? They probably would have burned you at the stake, right? I mean, it is a completely irrational way. But since people believe, is this what people don't get? It's all fake. It's all phony. Give me all your fake money, then I'll take it, right? Uh-huh. I'll take it tomorrow if you think it's all fake. It is real because we believe it's real. The vulnerability there, the second the psychology changes, the value can change either up or drastically down. And there is a point where people are going to start asking more and more questions about what the hell we're doing here. And I think there is a point where we run, and everybody's worried about the debt. I mentioned you last time we spoke. Unfunded liabilities. I think there's a point where people are going to look at that and realize how hopeless this is. And as confidence begins to degrade in a currency, to me, that's when you're going to get the biggest part of this crisis. And I think it might actually precede a fall off in energy production or many of the other things that you pointed out, that sooner or later, people are going to realize it just doesn't work. And in some ways, that could be the better crisis, because it would give us time to act, because we can fix that. We can fix that with the change to the way we do things. But I don't know that we have the wherewithal to do it. You see, your country's not interested in it. I think the problem in your country is as bad as the policymakers are and as bad as the elite are. I think the problem in this country is people are more concerned about how big Kim Kardashian's ass is than how the money system works. Yeah. That this country has been lulled to sleep. We have kids going around in college today filling out what I call butthurt reports on microaggressions, right? Because they don't feel safe because somebody said something they found off color, right? A society that starts to think this way cannot have the will to fix these problems. And it doesn't mean there's not millions of us to do, but for right now, I fear that we're outnumbered. And I think the percentage of people in each age group is going down. I think a lot of people look to the young guys, the millennials, et cetera, and think these are the ones that are really concerned with saving the world and saving the, you know, the whales and everything else. And yeah, they buy into a lot of things about, you know, we need solar and wind and everything, but they have no comprehension whatsoever about what that means or how hard it really is. I was at a workshop recently where a guy cut down a single tree. It was a kind of a junk tree, and we were using it for firewood after it was cut down, but it was to teach people how to use a chainsaw. And these young kids, very, very honorable young people in their like early 20s, far more concerned than I was at 20. I was concerned with chasing girls at 20 and drinking beer. Just to, you know, be honest here. These kids care. But they were asking questions. So that's like what? Like a quarter of a cord? No. That's kindling. That's one tall junk, you know, red pine. That's kindling. It's nothing. Like the concept that what it actually is, because all these kids were talking about is how you could heat a whole house with a few cords of wood with a rocket stove. They don't even know what a cord is. They don't know what a cord, they have no idea. What is the embodied energy in four by two by eight, right, of solid wood? What is the embodiment of energy there? How long does it take to produce that? Right? How sustainable is that really, unless you're doing things like coppicing and you're growing, you know, firewood crops that way, which is a very old technology that could be done, but nowhere near the level. I think we're going to put solar panels on the house. Yeah, a guy it wrote into me, you're going to put solar panels on a house. He was going to spend, it was going to take him 37 years financially to pay back those panels. And it wasn't like an off-grid system with battery backup. It's a grid-tied system. It doesn't even run the power if the grid goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And so these things, we have a population so uneducated to the, it's not that we can't adapt to these technologies, but you're not going to adapt to these technologies, walk into your living room, turn a thermostat down to 68 degrees in the middle of the summer, and just have it hum. The box that the aliens brought with free energy in it that's being hidden by Exxon does not exist. It just doesn't exist. You know what I'm saying, but I don't know that everybody that hears my voice does.
Well, well said, very well said. And to back up a bit in that, you know, one of the things that I've been working hard on is to differentiate this whole idea between money and wealth, right? Because it's been conflated and people think they're the same thing, and it's been marketed to us that money's real. And of course, all you have to do is peel back the covers and discover that, yeah, it's real for you. You got to work for it. And if you don't have it, you're under a bridge, right? But they don't, they being the, you know, they just, oh, I ran, dude, I had a $1 trillion accident. Oh, here it is. Very, very sorry for your losses. But money is not wealth, right? And so what you're talking about is a kind of wealth like that knowledge wealth. That's a form of capital. Kids can, you know, correct, people can have. You really understand not just the book learning behind what's in a 4x2x8, you know, chunk of wood, but the experience that says, oh, and here's how much it takes to get that. And, oh, by the way, red oak needs to dry for 2 years, especially after splitting, versus, you know, this red pine with totally different substance, right? It's not just wood. So there's a lot that goes with that. But still, a lot of people, I think, make the mistake of thinking, I have money, I have wealth. Well, you do, as long as the social agreement exists that you can exchange that for something that's useful to you. But when push comes to shove, history says money is a commodity. It goes up in value, it goes down in value. Sometimes it goes to zero. Who knows, right? But what doesn't change is wealth. People always want to be entertained. We need products. We want food. We want shelter, warmth. Those are the things that, you know, that are true forms of wealth. So I've been really encouraging people, if all you have is money wealth, I don't care how big your portfolio is, you got to start transitioning that over into the real world, which includes all these other forms of wealth we talked about in your last podcast, you know, that great line of thinking that came from those permaculture guys, you know, these other forms of capital, which is just what you get when you open your eyes, you look out into the real world and you say, oh, the real world doesn't operate just by money or any concept abstract like that. It operates according to, do you have water, nutrients, you know, shelter, safety, those sorts of things. Feels like we're, you know, that there's some really old sort of primal concepts that are going to have to come back into favor. And I guess what I'm saying is I feel like this last 150, 200 years of oil has been just a departure into la-la land. There's some basic realities that have to come back.
I think in some ways what we did is we grew up technologically faster than we grew up intellectually. Mm. I think that if we had the capacity for knowledge that does exist today, and despite pointing out how uneducated a lot of people are, there are a lot of extremely smart, extremely educated people in the world today. And if we had the knowledge that we have today and we discovered this resource today for the first time, I think we would treat it a bit differently. I think that we discovered it and our capacity to use it exceeded our capacity to comprehend it. And therefore, we became dependent on it way too quick. And the reason that people don't want to make the adjustment now is they can't see a way out of it. Where if you had told somebody that was living, you know, where they had to burn wood every day to keep their house warm, hey, you can have enough of this stuff that it'll do all these things for you. And it did 25% of what it does for us today. You know what they would have said? That's great. But if you tell somebody today to give up 25% of what it's doing for them now, they're not willing to do it. They're not even willing to invest in the technologies that would make you have to give up less of it. And what I mean by that is we can't take solar panels and run central air conditioning in 3,000 square foot stick and wood houses. We can't do it. But we can build houses that can be kept cool with that level of energy.
Right.
But we don't want to do that because we have all this embodied investment in building stick and wood houses. Right. There's the financial system is stacked. We're doing the most destructive behavior we could right now. We have building codes and entire cities have entire departments of people that exist solely for the purpose to make sure that we build things that way. When it's the worst, like no one that came here without any attachment to what we're doing. Like let's say an alien did show up without a free energy box, but just said, hey guys, I'm here. Is it like you at the conference, right? I'm an outsider. I'm an outsider looking in and I'm evaluating this. That person would never say, you know what? Keep building houses that way. Keep building subdivisions the way that you're doing. That makes sense. That's a good idea. Keep using these toxic materials in your homes that your children are growing up in. That's a good idea. Like, it's so preposterous if you extract yourself from it. But I'm sure even for you and I, there's things that you look at and go, I don't want to give that up. And then there's things that you look at and go, I'd be happy to do this a different way, but I'm actually inhibited and prevented from doing it a different way. If I wanted to tear my house down right now where I live and build an earth contact structure, where I live, I probably could. But I'd also need a couple tons of dynamite because I'm sitting on top of a limestone slab to be able to do that. But most people, it's not a limestone slab that prevents it from being financially viable. What do you think would happen in the average suburban neighborhood, Chris, if a guy brought in a track hoe and said, screw it, I'm going to fix this, ripped the house out, salvaged everything usable, and tried to put in something akin to an earthship?
An injunction would be administered almost instantly.
The track hoe would never make it there, right? I mean, it never would happen. So the things that actually can work, the system actively is prohibiting. So that puts you in a point where you either have to adapt within, you know, the confines of society. And I live kind of at the urban-rural edge, which is actually a really great place for taking advantage of what's here and being able to get the hell out if we have to. And that works for now. But if you really want to live and use the appropriate technology for adaptation, you have to go out in the sticks. And they're making that difficult now. So you can see why people are like, I get it, but it's not feasible for me to do. You know, and not everybody's going to be a hippie living in a tiny house. I'm not going to. I my office is bigger than most tiny houses, and I'm not going to change that. I have a job to do, and it's comfortable to be able to do it in there. But I could have this kind of office using a different building technology and be far more adapted to Texas summers than this home is that was built in 1979. Because you know what interest rates were in 79, right? So my house is built when you cut every corner when you built a house. And I've adapted as much as I can with that, but we all have those limits.
Well, absolutely. And you're raising a great point, though, which is that, look, we could be doing things a lot differently. And I know that you have a strong orientation towards permaculture, which I'm a huge fan of as well. And I watch things that people are doing now, and they seem worthy, right? They're complex. You have to really know your subject as well as any maestro of any musical instrument or you know, master of any particular craft. Really subtle, important stuff. And it turns out that we can be these incredible agents of abundance and creation. And that's what the human experience can be. We can be creators, extraordinary creators. That's the potential. The downside is we can also be knuckleheads and do really dumb things, right?
Yeah.
And that's the human experience. My concern at this particular juncture of human history is that the knuckleheads seem to be in charge, you know? I threw a couple of them out there, but, you know, what kind of a knucklehead did it take corrosive water and feed it through the Flint, Michigan water system when they have lead pipes and lead gets eroded by corrosion and goes into the water system? What kind of a knucklehead does that take? You know, it takes a special kind. It really does.
Hey, it saved $1 million. What do you want? So we poisoned a whole town. I mean, stuff happens. And by the way, we poisoned it in a way that we don't think we can ever fix it again.
Yeah. Just, it's a special kind. And my favorite tweet came out this morning. Somebody said, if Al-Qaeda had done this, we'd already be bombing the wrong country by now.
It's right. A special kind of stupid. If you've seen the meme with Sam Elliott in it, you're a special kind of stupid now, aren't you? And that's you're going, these are the people in charge. I think that, but what we have is, like, I think people mistake what being in charge is. These politicians and stuff, these are like, if you go back to the colonial days and they would install a governor in South Carolina, the king is still in charge. And the king ain't Barack Obama, and it wasn't George Bush before him. It is these banking interests. It is these oil interests. And so that's another thing you have to look at, right? These oil companies are the same companies in the end, the same people own them as own the banks. So are they really this bad off, or is there an advantage to them eventually for looking this bad off? Who knows? I really don't at this point. I'm with you on there's certain things I just go, I just don't know anymore.
Yeah, I know. I vacillate like, oh, these are evil individuals. No, they're idiots. I don't know. Could yes, both. I don't know. But it doesn't matter because the outcome is the same. So this is why I do what I do. I think it's why you do what you do. Listen, I'm not going to change what's going on in that larger setting. I can't influence what kind of knuckleheads are in charge, but I can influence people who see what's coming, who understand that they can be in charge of maybe not everything, but certainly more important subsets of things than they used to be, taking that responsibility back and saying, I'm in charge, I am responsible. Fundamentally, however this turns out in my life, I am responsible for that, you know, on some spiritual, existential level, more, you know, tactically. But I'm in charge, right? And so pulling that back, and that's my, you know, what I love, Jack, about doing what I do is I get to hang out with people who are curious. They're actually doing stuff. They're willing to admit, you know, when they're wrong or what they've got right, or, you know, that's just part of the curious sort of mindset. But this is a really extraordinary time to be alive. And I think that if you know, if anything, you know, life is to be, you should be fully connected to self and other, and you should be filled with a feeling of aliveness. And I'm convinced that a lot of, you know, the people that are living through life right now are neither of those things. They're neither connected and or alive, right? Neither of those. So last question here, because we get this one a lot. So what do you do? You know, how do you, I'm sure this conversation comes up in your people. How do you deal with, say, the friends, loved ones, colleagues, neighbors who are not yet ready to hear about anything that's unpositive?
Well, what I do with most of the people that observe what we're doing is allow them to do that. I allow them to observe what we're doing. I will occasionally plant seeds. I told my sister, and you would think by now, right? This is 8-9 years I've been doing this. They've seen the results of our lifestyle and the results of their own lifestyle. And I told her at a recent birthday party for my grandson, if you have, and I know she does because she's a teacher, so she's probably got a 401(3)(b). That's like a 401k for those that don't know. If you have one of those, and you're, I know Mark, her husband does too, you know, him too, just go in there right now and take all of the mutual funds that you're holding, and you're either going to have like a cash value fund, or at worst case, you're going to have like a government bond fund, and move your money into that. And I saw her roll her eyes. Okay, done, right? I mean, I'm done. And I think that's where people get frustrated and they get a lot of angst. It's so important that I convince them of this. No, I've done the honorable thing. I have information. I believe that it can help you. I've given you the information. And now I'm done. And I actually think that's more effective in convincing people than continuing to push. No one wants to be convinced against their will. Nobody wants you to go evangelize this stuff to them. I mean, I don't know what your religious beliefs and all are, but I'm pretty much of the belief that there's a God. I don't have all the answers, but I don't follow any organized religion. One of the surest ways to make sure that you never see me in your church is to continuously tell me I need to be saved. The more you push, the more resistant I'm going to be. And every human being is the same way when it comes to any subject like that. If you over push, then what that person does is entrench themselves. And every time they open their mouth to defend their position, they make it harder for themselves to change. And you think you're helping, but you're not. So what I try to do is simply live the best life that we can. We have our little 3-acre place. We have our ducks. We have our quail. We have our dogs. We have no debt. We live a wonderful lifestyle. When people want to do something, we always can go. If they want to go out and do something that requires a little bit of money, we can always go. Doesn't mean we always do, but it's never like I have to wait till I get paid to do that next week. We don't flaunt it, but we don't hide our success either. And I think that actually attracts more people than just telling them how wrong they are. Because I think what happens is a lot of people go out and do that before they correct their own shit. And then basically the person, their house is on fire, and they're telling their neighbor to put in fire extinguishers, right? And the neighbor's looking at the person going, I'm not going to take advice from you on this. And this goes back to my father was a pretty smart man. He was a Pennsylvania bootleg coal miner, all right? That's about his blue collar. That's like he didn't have a collar, right? He said blue collar, didn't have a collar, had a hard hat. And but he told me a couple of things that I'll always remember. And one was, never take advice from somebody on something unless they're more successful at you than you are at doing it. So I had an uncle named Stefan, my great uncle Stefan. He said, your uncle Stefan understands money. If your uncle Stefan tells you something about money, he is a multimillionaire and he did it as a blue collar factory worker. If he tells you something about money, you can probably take it to your bank. Your uncle Stefan would be far more of a multimillionaire if he hadn't been married 5 times. So don't take your Uncle Stefan's advice about women. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And I've tried to live that ethos in my life. So when somebody starts telling me how to do a better podcast, if they have a podcast and they're doing really well with it, I'm interested. If they've never done a podcast in their life, I'll take, you know, simple suggestions like can't hear you at the end because the music's too loud. Okay, yeah. But if you start trying to rewrite my entire programming I've been doing for 8 years, it's not that I don't value you as a person, but you're not qualified to advise me on that. And I think the reason that a lot of people get frustrated trying to switch on their friends and family to this line of thinking is they haven't traveled enough down the path themselves yet to be taken seriously by the person they're talking to. Like, listening to me or listening to you in itself is not a qualification to lecture somebody on a preparedness and resilient lifestyle. You know, what have you done? And I think that what happens is, so some of my most resistant people, when they come over the house, I built this system in the toolbox of my truck. So I have a great big truck with a big toolbox in the back of it, and in there sit two GC2 batteries with a couple inverters. And I don't drive that truck much anymore because I don't have to go anywhere, but it drives enough to keep it charged up. So everywhere I go, every time I use that, that residual energy that otherwise is just spinning an alternator that's going to spin anyway is dumping it into those batteries. And when the power went off here a couple weeks ago, instead of dragging the generator out and everything, I backed the truck up to the door, plugged into it, and ran the basics that we needed to, because there was some really bad storms going on. The tornadoes that hit Dallas the day after Christmas is what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
So we were able to run the TV and make sure we stayed weather aware using that. Now, when my friends and family come over and I show them that, they think that's cool. They like that. Or when they come over and I show them, like, this is a peach tree we planted 3 years ago. There's five buckets of peaches that came off it this year. Here's a bucket to take home. They think that's cool. So if you focus more on your results than what they should be doing, then, see, I think this is part of the salesman in me, right? If I want to get you to buy from me, the second you start asking me questions about how to buy, you're going to sign the contract, right? If I'm pushing, right, then you're not going to, then we're not going to get anywhere. But if I give you the information and back off and you start saying, well, how about this? Well, how does that work? I'm going to close the deal. So in this case, closing the deal is, here's a peach. Tastes better than one at the store, right? Yep. We grow them in our backyard. How do you do that? Bam. Let me show you.
And of course, the unfortunate part to the story, too, is that no matter what, we just have to be open to the idea that we may not be somebody's trusted source, no matter how
much. It might be worse, right?
We might not be that person, right?
It might be worse. It might be that you're too close. So Dave Ramsey calls it powdered butt syndrome, right? Kids can't give their parents advice about money. I think that's what he calls it anyway. Anybody that's ever powdered your butt will not take your monetary advice. Well, there's also, you know, they say I'm not a biblical person or anything, but I do know scripture here and there. And there's an old proverb that, or I don't think it was a proverb, I think it was actually from the gospel. A prophet has no honor in his own country. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I can probably reach your brother-in-law before you can.
Right.
Because I'm this third-party guy on, it doesn't matter, I'm just some redneck in Texas with a duck farm that started his show in a Volkswagen Jetta TDI in 2008, right? It doesn't matter. To him, I've got this show, and I'm not connected to him. Your brother doesn't want to listen to you unless he asked you. Now, if he asks you, he'll listen. But if he doesn't ask you, he's not wanting to listen to you unless you're telling him what he wants to hear. And it's just a fundamental reality there. And I'd like to say something real quick, if I could, because I know we're at the end here, about something you said about quality of life leading up to this. And, you know, we have to do the best we can with what we have. I was in the military, and I remember I had a captain that I served under who left to go to another unit and did a change of command ceremony where the new company commander comes in, and he turns the company over, and he gets a chance to say something to the company that he's leaving behind. And he said, men, one day you will die. You could die in service to your country, or you could die an old man 80 years from now. But when you die, they'll put you in the ground somewhere. They'll put a stone over your head. They might put a saying there, but they'll put two numbers on it. The day you were born and the day you died. In the middle, they'll put a dash. That dash is you. Be careful how you spend your dash. I was 18 years old when I heard that, and I remember verbatim. And I think that's what's missing in people's lives. They're living for tomorrow. They're living for the next day. They're not realizing that every second you waste is gone and it'll never come back. I think that, like, the most valuable thing that you could give people, if you could give them the illusion of this to see for a day, is a big giant tub in their bedroom with a bunch of little glowing marbles in it. And that's the number of days you got left on life. And when you wake up in the morning, you put that little marble in your pocket. At the end of the day, you throw it away. It disappears forever. And that's the reality we all live with. And we don't know how many of those marbles there are there for us. We just don't know. But inside each one of us is the potential for that individual day. How much we could do for ourselves, our families, our communities, for our individual liberty. How much we could do for society, for ourselves. Everything that we have the potential to do. And whatever you don't use is wasted. It's like a battery that you left, you know, left the power on, and you drained it to zero without getting anything out of it, and you have to throw it away at the end of the day. And if you don't get that, it's going to be very hard for you to separate yourself between those two circles that we learned about from Stephen Covey: concern and influence. And most people are spending 90% or more of their energy on the things they're concerned about, and 10% or less of their energy on the things they can actually influence. And if you'll flip that around, yes, I'm concerned about what the stupid people said in the Democratic debate last night a little bit, but I can't do anything about that. But I can go feed my ducks, and I can produce a product that I can feed to a customer that becomes part of that social capital, not just financial capital you're talking about. And that might not do it for you. Some of your people are like, I want to grow a duck. I don't want to put a solar panel on my house. Figure out what works for you and build a better life.
Very well said. So here it is. You know, 2008, you said you were sales and marketing. You were overweight. You're unhappy. How are you today?
Well, I was at least 300 pounds back then. I don't know how much I actually weighed back then, because I hit about 290 and I was afraid. I was embarrassed to get on a scale, even if no one was looking.
Right.
Today, I'm 210 pounds. I played football in high school at 190 pounds. I don't consider myself GQ material, but overall, I think that's probably better than the average American. My diet primarily is what you would call paleo or primal. Mm-hmm. I eat a lot of vegetables, very little starches, and a lot of meat, eggs. Everything that I eat is either, I wouldn't say everything, the majority of what I eat, I either produce on my own little farm or I buy locally. You know, kind of my scale is, if I can produce it, I produce it. If I can't produce, I buy it locally. If I can't get it locally, I buy it organic. And if I still can't get it and I need it, then I'll go ahead and buy it, you know, mass product market. My emotional, I mean, I think you can hear it in my voice, right? I'm pretty passionate and excited about what I do now. My wife and I just celebrated our 19th anniversary. I've got a son who just recently was married. I actually got my credentials of ministry online, because anybody can do that. And I was actually the minister for my son's wedding. I've got a grandson, and I've got a we think by the sonogram, I've got a granddaughter on the way. I'm in my 40s. You know, I've got a lot of life in front of me. I'm excited. I'm happy. My show reaches on average 150,000 people a day at this point. And I mean, again, it started out in a car. I do not have everything that I want, but I think I have everything that I could ever possibly need in my life. And I think that is all about living what I speak. I think there's a lot of people out there in kind of that motivational speaking world. And I feel like if I had gone into that, you know, put a suit on and made the circuit, I could have made a lot of money doing it. But I think it would be miserable, because I think most of those guys are doing that because they know they can make money doing it. I think when you live this way, that the fundamental reality is you find your own truth and you find your own version of liberty. My show's subject today was finding what freedom is for you. And I think what people really don't understand is most people say they want freedom, but they don't want freedom, because if you want to be able to do what you want, but you want to say that somebody across the street can't do what they want at a point where they're doing anything that is not infringing on your rights or liberty or freedom and not taking any aggression against you, you just don't like it, then you don't actually want freedom. Freedom's kind of messy. Freedom's kind of ugly. But what happens is you start to realize, like, all those things you want to prohibit people from doing, they're going to do them anyway, legally or illegally. If they do them illegally without a victim, all we do is create growth in our prison system, a burden for our future, and a whole bunch of people with destroyed lives. And we're doing it through a proxy because it feels comfortable to do it that way. And when you let go of that, and then you can only – see, once you do that, Chris, the only thing you can focus on is, well, gee, what am I going to get done today? And, you know, we've come up, I have a new group on Facebook called Regenerative Agriculture. All little producers like me all over the country sharing what works and how to produce things. And our big, like, kind of push statement is hashtag get shit done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you are getting shit done every day, positive things for the world, positive things for yourself, you're going to be more healthy spiritually, emotionally, physically. I'll put it to you another way, too. I'm a guy that was 300 pounds in 2008. I haven't been to the doctor in 10 years. I live an amazing life today because I live the way we're talking about. And I believe that anybody can do it. It's just up to you if you really want to.
And that's one of the things that makes you and Adam and I very, very similar is you got to walk the talk. But I don't walk the talk as a marketing strategy. I do it because It's a matter of integrity. I can't I don't know how to be any other way, right? So,
well, you can't, because let's say if you have handlers and you're on the radio and you have this isolated life, you can live a false image online and on the air. The way you're doing things, the way I'm doing things, you can't do it for as many years as we've been doing it, because you're going to get burned. I mean, people, I have workshops where 50 people come to my house and stay here for a week, right? I can't be bullshitting and get away with that in this way that we live. And I know you live very publicly as well about what you're doing and what your projects are and things like that. And there's an authenticity there that you can't break, but there's also a fundamental reality that you can't live that way in the public eye. What we do is actually, I think you admit, on some levels it's difficult, because a lot of times you're doing a project you want to document, you could have been done, you're still setting up ways to document it, right? Mm-hmm, right? Or you do something and you make one small error that doesn't really matter, and 400 people show up in 15 seconds to tell you what you've done wrong. But I'm like you, I couldn't live any other way. There's too much joy in it.
Absolutely. Well said. And so we are at the end of our time. What a fantastic conversation. I knew this was going to be fantastic. Thank you, Jack. And it's just, I can't wait till we meet in person someday. It will happen. So tell our listeners where they're going to find out more about you, your work, the people you reach, your community. How do they find you?
Sure. My website is thesurvivalpodcast.com or thesurvivalpodcast.com, depending on where you grew up mm-hmm. and how say the word the or the. The shortcut to it, I have a little short URL domain. It's really nice on phones, tspc.co. tspc.co will lead you there. That will lead you to my site with all my podcasts on it. Occasionally I do a blog entry and all, but it's most entries are podcasts. From there you can link off to my Facebook page, my Twitter account, all that stuff. We have a forum that's been running almost since the beginning of the show, about 6 months in. I had a group of people from the audience say, you will give us a forum. I'm like, I don't have time. They're like, we'll run it. So I set up a forum. It's one of the best and well-run forums online today. And I don't really do it. They run it just like they promised to that many years ago. It is an incredibly great group of people. We also have a Zello channel. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Zello, Chris, but Zello is like you turn your smartphone into like a little ham radio almost. Except you're not using the ham bands. It's using the internet. And we have a Zello channel where people get together and talk to each other. It is the largest channel on Zello. It's big enough that the Zello board of directors had a conference call with our Zello users to ask how to make it better. Nice. The knowledge that's being shared on there. And I mentioned the new regenerative agriculture group. That is there as well. So your folks... this is open to anything from homesteaders to broadacre people doing cattle, as long as it's being done in a common sense, regenerative way. But those especially that are interested in making at least some level of an income off of producing food in an environmentally friendly way, I think you'd really enjoy this. We've grown. I started that group 90 days ago, and it's almost 8,000 people. So we have a lot going on over there. Please come join us. As I mentioned, I think it was 1714 or 1715 today that we did. So there's over 1700 episodes of the Survival Podcast. There's a search box. There's a tag cloud. If you want to know about something, we've probably covered it. I will tell your listeners this. If I have not pissed you off today, if you listen to my show long enough, I will. I would say something you don't like, something you don't agree with. I will upset you. Politically, I'm an anarchist. And if you listen to the whole thing, and some people do that, you can hear me turn from libertarian to anarchist over 8 years. For those that are freaked out, anarchy is not what you think it is. And that's why it took me so long to change my philosophy, because it's not really a political stance. It's a philosophy. So I will upset you. I will say things you don't like. But it's always done with an intent of challenging people to think for themselves. And what I'll finish with is I put together this modern survival philosophy, these 12 tenets that guided my show since day one. And number 10, I think I should move to 12 because it's the most important. What you do matters. No matter who you're listening to, whether it's me, whether it's Chris, whether it's any of the other people doing great work out there, the examples you're following, pulling stuff on YouTube to learn how to make a rocket mass heater or whatever. In the end, you have to do the things that work in your life for you. Because if I give you a plan or Chris gives you a plan, it's like a paint by numbers plan. It says you must do A, B, C, D. You'll follow it right up to the point where you don't want to do it. You'll quit and you'll fall off the wagon right there. And you'll end up less prepared in the end. where if you're given the freedom and the respect of being a fellow human being that can think for themselves, and people like Chris and I, we identify as people that want to give you knowledge to empower you, and then you take that knowledge and do with it as you please, then you're going to find a route to success. It might not look the same as mine, but it shouldn't. You're a different person in a different world with different needs, desires, and wants, and that's okay.
Very well said. And of course, very inspiring as well. You know, we have a lot of similarity, and it comes down to, I think you want the same thing I do, which is you don't want to lead anybody. You want to give people the tools that they have and that they can use, because who knows what they're going to do with them. This is just a giant creative process we're all involved in. I don't know what anybody's going to need, but I do know that if we have the right context and if we have the right attitude and we have, you know, there's three things here. It's what you know, it's what you do with it, and it's also that state of being. Like, how are you really present with it? That gets more into a spiritual side or a religious side for some people. But those three things, knowing, doing, being, overlap those, get to the sweet spot in the center, and then you're living. And so, of course, you're right. This is the dash. We are all living the dash right now. So with that, thank you so much for your time today, and I really hope we can do it again, and I'm going to meet you in person someday.
Absolutely, Chris. Well, maybe you can get out to Permaculture Voices in March. It would be awesome to have you out there. I could probably get Diego to throw you a free ticket, and it'd be a great place for you to learn more about that stuff. That'll be in California. I think it's March. I'm going to be gone 1-9, so it's somewhere in that hole right there. And I'd love to meet you in person someday, definitely. If you ever want me to come back on the air with you, maybe to dive into a single topic, I'm happy to do it. And otherwise, again, thank you for the opportunity to reach your guest today. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the work you've done. And I still remember, I was still working my full-time job when I got that first DVD, and you sent it to me to reach out to me of Crash Course. And it was one of the best pieces of work that I'd ever seen on the subject in my life. And now knowing how you did it makes it even more impressive. So if nothing else, thank you for that, because I know it woke up a lot of people.
It was a Plantronics headset and a lot of sweat and tears. That's all. All right. Well, Jack, thank you so much again.
Thank you as well.